On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. CNN anchorman crusader Lou Dobbs is on a roll these days, rolling fury. The one-time standard-issue Republican business reporter has morphed in the last few years into a fire-breathing super-critic of corporate greed and elite nonchalance about what he sees as the crushing of America's vast center. Failing schools, failing healthcare, failing wages, open borders, money puppet politicians, CEOs raking it in while families struggle. Lou Dobbs now calls it open warfare on the middle class. Critics charge him with class warfare hysteria and xenophobic jingoism, but Lou Dobbs' ratings are soaring. Up next, On Point cable news crusader Lou Dobbs says it's war on the middle class and he's fighting back. Joining me now from New York is Lou Dobbs. He's the anchor and managing editor of Lou Dobbs Tonight on CNN. He's out with a new book, War on the Middle Class, how the government, big business, and special interest groups are waging war on the American dream and how to fight back. Lou Dobbs, welcome.
Tom, great to be with you again.
It's been a couple of years since we last talked. Last time it was all about offshoring of American jobs. Wow, have you broadened your critique? War, outright war on the middle class? I mean, can it get any bigger and broader than that?
I hope it doesn't, because this is broad enough to engage the very idea of the nation. And in the time since focusing on exporting of jobs to cheap overseas labor markets, the rise of illegal immigration, the continued failure of our public education system, the middle class is just absolutely caught in the sights of the political and business elites in this country, and they mean harm, certainly not good.
You know, your fury over this has risen to the point where it brings to mind the old, I'm mad as hell and not going to take it anymore scream. You've got critics at this point who are beginning to portray you as a kind of nutter, so far out there that Lou Dobbs just, is way off the reservation. But night after night, you're hanging in there point by point. So where's your center of gravity these days? Can you be this angry and still be a careful analyst of what's going on in this country?
Well, no one should ever confuse frustration with outright anger. Oh, I am angry about people who should know better speaking untruths, outright lies, and distorting reality, which unfortunately encompasses some in the national media. But, Tom, my anger is really born of a system that right now is entirely dominated by corporate America. The legislative system is completely dominated. Over $2 billion in lobbying money being spent by corporate America each year to influence the opinions and views, the votes, and the direction of 536 people, the president, 100 senators, and 435 congressmen. Mm. I'm more than a little concerned about the upcoming election next Tuesday, in which we will have spent $2.6 billion, nearly all of that corporate money. Corporate America has absolute dominion over our political process and system in this country, whether it's electoral or legislative. And there is no countervailing influence. And we have to find one, and one soon, because waiting for corporate America to find a conscience is not a productive use of time.
What's going on here at this big margin you're describing? I mean, traditionally, Americans are not anti-business. You well know that. Traditionally,
right.
You were anything but anti-business. I mean, you had a business show on CNN.
Mm-hmm.
So clearly you're saying something has changed here,
right.
that's radical. What is it?
Well, let's talk about some of those changes, Tom, and that's a great point. I'm not anti-business by any stretch of the imagination. I would guess that I am as pro-free enterprise democracy as anyone in the country. I'm as much of a capitalist as nearly anyone. But unfettered capitalism I absolutely reject, and I would hope that the country would begin to. We have a situation in which a number of things have changed. One, obviously, September 11th, which makes our border security and our port security paramount for the national in the national interest. Mm. We have gone through the longest series of corporate corruption scandals in this country's history, and they continue. And frankly, they continue unabated, whether it be stock option backdating, whether it be outright fraud. Corporate America has not learned its lesson from Enron and WorldCom and all of the other scandals at the beginning of this new century. And to ignore the reality that is a business elite and a political elite that have decided to put our middle class into direct competition with the cheapest labor in the world is the height of stupidity, in my opinion. Many are doing just that.
Lou, I read the book, and I mean, the picture that emerges to me that you're painting here looks something like this. First of all, you call the middle class, I mean, it's almost everybody, practically 280 million out of 300 million. So you're painting middle class very, very big. And then you describe the sort of privileged, rich, corporate America as being prepared to destroy the fabric of 280 out of 300 million to line its own pockets. That no matter what, as long as they're making out okay, the rest can just go to hell in a handbasket. But that sounds so outrageous, it's hard to believe. I mean, in a democracy, 280 million out of 300 sounds like something that you couldn't undermine, destroy, beat up on forever, and get away with it.
Even if you tried, right, Tom?
Right.
The idea that, and I do define the middle class as everyone but the wealthy and the poor in this country. But a couple of things have to, I come to none of my conclusions without a lot of analysis and looking to the facts. You suggested I have critics who say that I'm over the top on some of this. The problem is when those are usually ad hominem attacks, usually through a partisan position and then filter, and usually almost never any factual discussion. Here are the facts. When I talk about the wealthy in this country, let's look at the facts. The facts are that corporate America had modest influence 40 years ago in this country when it comes to influencing our legislation. There were 62 lobbyists in 1968 in this country. Mm-hmm. Today, there are 34,000 registered lobbyists in Washington, D.C.
Spending $5.8 million a day, that's more than me or you.
You're exactly right. Or anyone, I suspect, listening to either of us. And that's overwhelming. There is no countervailing influence to that kind of money and that kind of influence seeking. The 2005 bankruptcy law, passed and signed last year by the president, was not influenced by corporate America. It was not suggested or shepherded by corporate America. The language of that legislation, and now law, was actually written by the credit card company lobbyists. Now, I talked with George Mitchell, and I've asked him on this one. We were talking at about the time this was being signed. And I said, George, this is absolutely the most blatant example I've ever seen of just raw power driving through our legislative system. And he said, you know, Lou, things were bad when I was in Congress, in the U.S. Senate. But we never allowed the corporate interest to actually write the legislation.
Here it is, just hand it to the Congress and say, we've written it, you just stamp it, let's go.
Never mind that just about half of all the personal bankruptcies in this country are caused by a family going through a devastating medical emergency or illness. It's unconscionable what we're witnessing in this country.
Going down your punch list, Lou, on wages, you say there's a problem there. Wages way up among the corporate elite and going nowhere among the mass.
Well, let's go back 40 years as a benchmark. 40 years ago, the typical CEO earned 40 times what the average employee of that company made. Today, it's 400 times what the employee makes. And across the broad range, the smallest corporations to the largest, it works out to 262 times what the average employee makes, which means that the average employee must work an entire year in order to make what that CEO makes in one day. Now, that is about as screwed up an alignment of economic interests and reward for productivity and contribution as you could imagine.
But Americans are told, hey, we're in a global competition. We've got to pay these guys well. And you, dear American, should just go to school and study hard so you can compete in this global economy.
Right. And that's wonderful. The same people who are saying that are the same people who are withdrawing those jobs from this economy and this society and sending them to cheap labor markets overseas, reducing the tax base, reducing the commitment on the part of the corporation to funding public education, which is the great equalizer of our society. They're reducing any of their responsibilities to other stakeholders beyond the shareholders, that is the employees, the communities in which they're based and operate, and to the nation in which permitted their founding and their success. It is, again, about as wrong-headed and upside-down as we could have it. And what's really striking, Tom, is that people refuse to look at the reality. I happen to believe in a nonpartisan, independent reality that influences all of us. It is our environment. Our reality is not made up of the Republican view, the Democratic view, partisan views, ideological extremes or positions. There is a nonpartisan, independent reality that we all have to have the courage and the intelligence to look at, and look at clearly and honestly.
Lou Dobbs, I want to talk with you about politics and parties for a minute. You're saying a pox on both their houses about Republicans and Democrats. We want to understand that, but let's get President Bush in our ear for just a second. Here he was this week on Monday in Sugar Land, Texas, promoting the benefits of his tax cuts.
We believe that you know how to spend your money far better than the federal government can. We believe that when you have more money in your pocket to save, invest, or spend, the economy benefits. The Democrats want more of your money because they think they can spend it better than you can.
There's the president this week in Tom DeLay's old district standing up for the little guy. How about it, Lou Dobbs? Are you buying it?
Not really, no. I don't think so. I don't think many people are. The fact is that the wealthy in this country receive just about three times the tax benefit as did working men and women in this country as a result of the tax cuts that the Bush administration has put through. And I love the idea, Tom, that that Republicans don't want to spend your money, but Democrats do. I think what the president was saying, perhaps, is Democrats want to spend your money now, perhaps by raising taxes, and Republicans want to spend your children's money and your grandchildren's money through deficits, because we have a $250 billion deficit. The size of this government is growing on average 6% a year. So I think that is a really an obfuscation of a reality that perhaps is, you know, uncomfortable for President Bush, but nonetheless a reality.
So take us into how Lou Dobbs thinks about American politics these days. We've got here Peter Beinart at the New Republic. He calls you the most left-wing commentator on mainstream television. When you go after, you know, the bought and paid for corporate America, war on the middle class, the GOP tried to link a minimum wage hike to a repeal of the estate tax. You call that obscene. He says this is the guy. And you know, you're not just on your show now. You're popping up all over CNN. He says you're turning mild-mannered CNN into the closest thing the United States has to an anti-corporate network, and yet you're not signing up with the Democrats either. Where do you position yourself politically?
I am as independent as I think anybody in this country could be. The Democratic Party has a treasured tradition of working in behalf of working men and women in this country, working with organized labor. I think it has wonderful traditions in our country, political traditions, social traditions. But as we look at what is happening, and the Republican Party, you know, I for years was what you would call a Rockefeller Republican. If you look at the Republican Party, it has moved to something that's unrecognizable as well. Religion dominating political discussions, the catering, even pandering to the religious right within the national leadership of the Republican Party. No responsibility in terms of prudent management of government finances and operations. It is a peculiar admixture. When we come to the point that the Clinton administration, a Democratic administration, is responsible for balancing the budget in the 1990s, A Republican administration is responsible for blowing the budget out in the new century. Whether one looks at social policy, the politics of either party, or the basic philosophy, the two parties are unrecognizable in terms of their traditions right now.
Are you still a Republican?
I'm an independent. I went down, I went down in New Jersey. I live in New Jersey and work in New York, as you know. And I went down and registered as a unaffiliated. You can't register as independent in New Jersey. You have to be unaffiliated.
And you're encouraging everyone to do that. But you're saying that would put the pressure on the parties. But wouldn't that, Lou Dobbs, in fact, because of our primary election system in this country, wouldn't it sort of give both parties over to extremists in their own ranks, kind of the opposite of what you're suggesting here?
Yeah, I think I understand your question, questioning that premise, but let me explain why I would suggest this. First of all, only 15% of voters bothered to go to the polls in our primary elections this year. That is the lowest turnout in our nation's history. It just tells so much about the climate in which we're now living. It's one of the reasons I'm skeptical about some of the projections for Tuesday. Because while the Democrats talk about an excited base and the Republicans talk about their excited base, I believe that 15% turnout, which is never a harbinger, an accurate harbinger of what we can expect on the general election, I do believe it speaks to the ennui that has gripped the nation that says, you know, the major decisions have been made. Both political parties are corporate parties. They are, as my friend James Entume says, you know, one wing of the same bird. And the bird is clearly being directed straight at our middle class. The idea that you register as an independent, and the reason it appeals to me that 10 or 20 million of us did that, I would just, for all the world, love to see the faces of Ken Melman at the Republican National Committee, and Howard Dean at the Democratic National Committee, understanding that finally the middle class is saying, you're going to take care of our interests. You're going to begin to talk about the common good. You're going to talk about the national interest. You're going to work on the cornerstone of this democracy, and that is equality, equality of rights, equality of economic opportunity, equality of educational opportunity.
Okay, let me ask you about that big framework then. I mean, you followed business for a long time. You know the arguments of eminent historians. They've got Nobel Prizes all over their shelves that say, you know, the bigger the market, the more trade, the better off everyone's going to be in the end. Globalization, we've been told now for 20 years, is the path to that. Open up the world economy. Right. It's going to be great for everyone. Of course, there's dislocation and pain along the way. But are you, I mean, and it's brought you an audience. I mean, your ratings are up 33% this year, I'm reading. That's pretty terrific. But are you playing on pain that is, in fact, a part of growing the whole pie, that at the end of the day would make everybody better off if Lou Dobbs would just calm down a little bit and not get everyone to bar the door?
Sure. You know, I'm actually the problem, Tom. Take me off the air and everything will be fine.
But what you know, there's a big school of economic thinking that says you've got to do this. You've got to go global. That's the way to growth for all.
Right. And I speak to these orthodoxies in the book. It may be that it's peculiarly American, perhaps not. But we have a way of seeding and growing and nurturing an orthodoxy as quickly as any society I'm aware of. An orthodoxy has grown up around free trade and that says free trade is going to work no matter what the result. But I ask people to step back and ask themselves a couple of questions. One of them is, if free trade as it's practiced by the United States is such a terrific idea, why don't our major trading partners follow the same principles? They work to maintain reciprocal, balanced, mutual trade relationships so they don't have immense deficits.
But you've got champions for free trade all over. I mean, look at The Economist out of London. They'll champion free trade all night and all day. They're not American.
Sure. No, they're not. And that's what I'm saying to you, is why in the world would we not follow the example of the good people of Great Britain, the United Kingdom? They practice balanced, mutual, reciprocal trade. We practice giveaways. The U.S. Trade Representative this year, Tom, has twice admitted that our free trade policies are creating deficits in perpetuity.
1929, 30, 31, trade barriers went up. The economy came crashing down. Would your line have that happen again?
I would never want that to happen again. Let me speak to that in just a moment. But actually, Smoot-Hawley was passed in 31. The Depression started quite early. You know, the crash of 29 took place 2 years before it. So the historians love to, free trade advocates love to cite that, but they always miscite it. The reality is, I've never called for protectionism, yet the Bush administration wants to frame me as an economic isolationist or a protectionist. And as is typical with this administration, and then it carries across into all of these other orthodoxies, they create these false choices. If it's Iraq, it's stay the course or cut and run. Those are the only two policy options that the Bush administration recognized, or at least until a week ago. In economic policy, it's you're an economic isolationist or you're a free trader. My question to everyone is this. If free trade is such a brilliant idea as it's practiced by the United States, why have we run trade deficits for 30 consecutive years? How much longer do you think we can sustain $5 billion in trade debt that we've run up in just the last decade? Our trade debt has risen faster than the national debt, which is now $9 trillion. We're set to see our trade debt rise above the national debt.
Lou Dobbs is with us. His new book is War on the Middle Class. And, Lou, there are a lot of listeners who want to speak with you. But there's one more issue I want to get out there before we turn to these very full phone banks here. That is immigration, illegal immigration in particular.
Right.
This is where Lou Dobbs has just sort of been bouncing off the walls night after night, outraged at what's going on.
I love the imagery.
Well, I mean, you know, you can't miss it, Lou. I mean, you've really sort of stretched the model of what anchors do on air in sort of mainstream news in your opposition to an uproar over illegal immigration.
No one should get, Tom, too concerned about the traditional role of an anchor. I don't fill that role. My program begins each night with the words news, debate, and opinion. I'm straightforwardly an advocacy journalist. I do straight news, but I also am a man of some considerable number of opinions. My audience expects them.
And pretty
is that a fair statement?
Andy Borowitz wrote in Newsweek that President Bush ought to just move you to the Mexican border instead of 6,000 National Guard troops. What is it about this one that sets you off on such a huge tear?
Okay, there are a couple of things. But first and foremost, from September 11th on, we have... we're losing lives in Iraq and Afghanistan. We're fighting two wars there, a global war on radical Islamist terror. And this country can excuse not securing our borders, for crying out loud, or inspecting only 5% of the cargo entering this country? That's irrational, don't you think, Tom?
Are you really worried about armies of Al-Qaeda coming across the Rio Grande?
I'm not worried about armies of them. But I am worried, very much, very concerned, and I can't imagine why anyone would not be, that we would see terror. I mean, we are taking shoes off of 85-year-old women in wheelchairs at our airports, but we don't think it would be relevant to think about someone crossing into this country.
I thought the heart of your concern had more to do with low-wage labor flooding into this country.
I'm just
getting
there.
That seems to be where it lies.
You will permit me more than one basis for my concern.
Yeah.
And the other is $25 billion is estimated by the DEA to flow across our border from Mexico in illegal drugs each year. Mexico is the leading source of methamphetamines, cocaine, heroin, and marijuana to this country. The estimates range as high as $45 billion. That seems to me to be a worthwhile reason to consider securing the border and knowing precisely what and whom is crossing that border.
And what about the labor issue?
On the labor issue, the cry in this country is from certain socio-ethnic-centric groups who are Hispanic activist groups primarily, that this country needs more labor. And my question is, if we need more labor, why don't we do it legally? We have an H-2 program, a visa program that is a guest worker program already. Why not carry out a legal immigration into this country rather than illegal? And secondly, if we need labor at the lowest wage scales in this country, why is it that we see wages declining in the lowest quintile of income groups in this country rather than rising? Because if there's a shortage, those numbers would be rising, not falling.
Okay, there's the Lou Dobbs agenda. It's most of it on the table there. There's more, but we've got listeners who really want to speak with you.
Sure.
Let me go first to Nashville, Tennessee, and Christina. Hi, Christina. You're on the air with Lou Dobbs.
Hi, Tom. How are you doing?
Hi, good. What do you think?
Well, I wanted to talk about an experience I had when I went to Mexico right after I graduated from college, and I met this family in Cuernavaca, and there weren't any men in the family. The women were amazing. They had their masters, they were nurses, they were professors, but all of them were unemployed because after NAFTA passed and a couple years came down the road in Cuernavaca, the middle class was absolutely destroyed. And so all of their husbands were in that nifty guest worker program in Florida growing tomatoes.
So is this good for Mexico, bad for America? How do you read it?
I think it's bad for both of us. And I was wondering, how long do you think it's going to take for the United States middle class to be in the same position? Like, they couldn't buy toilet paper, they kids to school, or any of that because their middle class has been so decimated. They moved from middle class to the absolute poor, where their husbands, who also had those degrees, you know, were the only job they could get was to go to the United States and work as tomato pickers.
Christina, we've got it. Lou Dobbs, that bad? Americans going to be the next Mexican economy sending their husbands off to work in India?
I don't think it will be sending their husbands off to India, but the reality is that wages, middle-class wages in this country have been basically, in real terms, stagnant for 30 years. And I think the young lady is absolutely correct. There is no floor under the decline in wages that we're watching. Because as the middle class has been put into direct competition, and this is precisely what happened in southern Mexico, by the way. I'm one of those people who supported NAFTA because I believed on the very esoteric economic theory that if we're to enrich anyone, we should enrich our neighbors in our trade. But I also...
Doesn't sound so esoteric.
I'm being more than facetious. But what has happened has been the inverse. And it's because we did not sign those side letters that Bill Clinton said we would, which was to protect labor and to protect the environment in large measure. But we have, as a result of NAFTA, devastated their middle class, aided in what has been a devastation of their middle class, I should say. And we've lost 1 million jobs in this country. That's despite the fact that we have a $50 billion trade deficit with Mexico. The Mexican workers in this country, Mexican nationals, are shipping back more than $25 billion a year in remittances. People forget when they look at the illegal immigration issue that it's more than just a little complex, but the effects are straightforward. The idea that Mexico is the poorest nation and that there should be this sentimental sort of reflexive attitude that we should bring in any illegal immigrant and make them citizens. The fact is we're the social safety valve for government of Mexico. And Mexico is not the poorest. If we're to bring people here who are poor, who need opportunity, that should be a function of our lawful immigration policy. Because the facts are these. Mexico is the wealthiest nation in Latin America, not the poorest.
We're talking this hour with the furious cable news crusader Lou Dobbs. His new book is War on the Middle Class, How the Government, Big Business, and Special Interest Groups Are Waging War on the American Dream and How to Fight Back. Sam's calling from Hingham, Massachusetts. Hi, Sam. You're on the air.
Good morning, Tom, and hello, Lou. Gotta love Lou.
Hello.
I'll tell you what, there's not much I can... What can you add to what Lou's saying? It's just... It's right on the mark. I mean, we basically got a feudal society in America now. Both parties are owned by the royalty. The parties are the vassals. 13,000 hyper-rich families and corporations are the royalty. Right and left corporate America keep the populace overfed, hypnotically entertained. It's bread and circus. The populace is swayed back and forth like a blade of grass in the swamp.
Sam, is the populace as lazy and ineffectual as all that? It's a democracy. If it's that bad, why don't Americans just go and vote for a change?
Well, that's the problem. That's the crux of it. Americans, I mean, nothing much has changed in 200 years. It's just that the power of the weapons involved, the tools, i.e. the information systems and so forth, are so much more powerful than they were. And, of course, the stakes are much bigger. We're talking about the survival of the country. But if as long as you keep people caring more about what Paris Hilton did last night and what's going on in the NASCAR circuit than what is actually relevant to people's lives and their own good fortunes in the short and long term.
Maybe that's it. Maybe that's it. Sam, thanks for calling. Lou Dobbs, really, are Americans that kind of, you know, pusillanimous? Are they not going to stand up and sort of take their own interest into their own hands?
Well, I think Sam, first of all, with his colorful descriptive language, has put it forward in a way in which I couldn't really argue much. I wouldn't put it quite that strongly, but probably I wouldn't put it that colorfully either. So my hat's off to you, Tom, to Sam. The idea, Tom, that we have a feudal society. Let's examine that just for a second. And you suggesting that we have a democracy, which we do, a democratic republic. Mm. But if we have one party that has two brands, Republican and Democrat, we have not seen significant change in this country on the basic issues that are fundamental to the well-being of most Americans, whether it be public education, the great equalizer. We're failing an entire generation of Americans. I was raised, I was born into a working-class family. Both of my parents worked throughout their working lives. Public education made all the difference in my life because my teachers luckily didn't care one way or the other that I was just a poor kid sitting there in jeans and a T-shirt. Mm-hmm. They encouraged me. They supported me. It made all the difference in my life. What hurts me badly is that millions of young kids are not getting that opportunity today, and we're not looking at the reality. Neither party is dealing with this issue as the emergency and the crisis that it is.
I can just imagine Democrats listening to you, Lou, and saying, come on, we're sitting out here, we're trying to take mm-hmm. back Congress. This is our agenda that you're talking right. about. We are the champion of the working people. Is it really impossible?
I really think that we'll have a great task come Tuesday, because if the Democratic Party does win control of Congress, I will be the first to cheer if it turns out that the Democratic leadership is actually more than a corporocracy servo. The fact is, I'm very, very skeptical of either party because they are funded by the very same people. It's one of the reasons we haven't had fundamental resolution of issues. We have great discussion of issues. We see legislation pass, but nothing gets resolved in Washington D.C.
Let me take a call, if I may, Lou, from Charles City, Iowa. We've got Mary on the line there. Mary, hi.
Hello. These are my comments. I'm a working class person, I have a lot of ideas. I'd like to buck the system, kind of have a quiet revolution
right.
where it would be the communities would work together. They'd start co-ops in all different facets of business, and right. where the employee can have ownership.
So a revolution against what, Mary?
Against corporate, the big corporate, against Home Depot, the cookie cutter landscape, Home Depot, Walmart, where they treat, it's just a person
big box
doesn't
America.
Feel like a person when you're in those big corporations.
So bring on a quiet revolution. Lou, do you really see the corporations as sitting around saying, how can we screw the American people? Is that really what
Certainly not all of them and not all CEOs, but enough of them to inflict great pain. And when the young lady talks about big box retailing and big box America, it resonates, I'm sure, with a lot of people because there's an despite a greeter at the front door, there is an impersonal and sterile sense to it all. Walmart is now the third leading export market for China. And yet, if she wants to lead a revolution, I would urge her to think about what I said. A quiet statement, but a loud statement with great impact. And that is to register as an independent or unaffiliated. Send that message back. 10 to 20 million Americans doing that, I think, will send a loud and clear message to both political parties. But in terms of creating co-ops, where both political parties talk about our dependency on foreign oil, Tom, but no one talks about even greater dependencies. We have a greater dependency on foreign producers for our computers and consumer electronics and technology equipment. We have a greater dependency on foreign producers for our clothing.
You're really going to close the factories in China, bring them all back here, and the world will be hunky-dory? Does it really work that way in a globalized century?
Can you imagine a top Chinese government official saying to one of his colleagues 20 years ago, you're really going to close all the factories in America and move them all over here. Why not?
Why not? Chris is calling from Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Hi, Chris. You're on the air.
Hi, Lou. Hi, Tom. How are you?
We're good. What do you think, Chris?
Well, Lou couldn't be more right. You know, I've watched him on CNN, and I just graduated college, and I can't get ahead. I have student loans. I have payments, and corporate America is burying the middle class, and they have bought our government. They have bought the legislators. They have bought the executive branch, and they have bought both parties. And until we get a new party in there, until we have a real revolution, which we can't have because the elite and the rich is in power, and there's no way you can be in power unless you are rich. So the rest of us, you people wonder why no one wants to be part of our government. No one votes anymore. It's the lowest voting percentage in history. It's because everyone is sick of it. Americans have moved on. They moved on with their lives, and they've become complacent, and they've moved on. And no one wants to be part of this government anymore. And it's gonna, there's going to be a backlash, whether it's in 10 years from now or 15 years from now, right, or 50 years. We need a revolution to get this government back to what we founded as the founding fathers had this government to start with.
Chris, we've got it, and we appreciate your call. Lou Dobbs. Now, there's Chris saying we're going to have a backlash. We're going to have a revolution. A call from Iowa says a quiet revolution. Mm-hmm. You're saying just register as an independent. That doesn't exactly sound like a revolution, though maybe it would be. What are you really suggesting here?
I'm suggesting that people, it is the most straightforward, easiest thing that we could do. Our middle class to register as independents, tell both parties effectively, go to hell. We're not going to deal with this charade any longer, and we're going to insist upon representation. 95% of the people in this country consider themselves to be middle class. They are literally without representation in Washington, D.C. You are hopeful come Tuesday that the Democratic Party will be able to provide that. If you're hopeful, Tom, I'm with you.
I don't know. I mean, that's what they're saying. That's why we exist. We're here. We're the alternative.
My problem is I've covered what these politicians of both parties have said for 30 years, and I have yet to see it materialize. But we have to return to a commonality, and that is our common experience, our common traditions and values. The cornerstone value of this nation is equality, as I said, and we really have to find a way to get to it, because I think the young man is quite right. If this continues in this direction, nothing less than a sharp change, whether that be a revolution, whether it be a new party, I think it would be obviously a peaceful evolution politically rather than a revolution. But something has to happen, because the direction in which we're going means that the United States will be a debtor nation in perpetuity. It means our middle class will shrink to an unrecognizable dimension, and that we will be left with an even wider gap than we're already experiencing between our wealthy and the poor. And when that occurs, society becomes a self-correcting mechanism. I wouldn't want us to get that far, because if we get that far, the pain of the process of getting that far would be unbearable for millions of Americans. Mm. It's already unbearable for millions of Americans. But if we will simply awaken to the reality, that would be the good first step.
Lou, let me ask you about something on the immigration front. I mean, one of the questions that's been raised here has been around, I mean, America's looking at a ethnically, racially, demographically changing country. We heard a lot about this at the 300 million mark, and there's a lot more to come. Whites, when we hit the next 100 million mark, 400 million, whites are projected to be just about half of the country. Now, you're tapping a populist vein here, and populism can have great utility. I completely understand that. But it can also go off in lots of directions, you know, driven by some stuff that's not so beautiful.
Right.
And some people have heard that as an undertone in your own criticism on illegal immigration. You know, the Nation did this big report, and they say, well, Lou Dobbs, he can have his opinion on immigration, but he's getting awfully close here to white supremacists and others using materials on your broadcast from the CCC. Let me just quote this. This is a group that says that blacks are a retrograde species, warning that immigration is turning the U.S. population into a slimy brown mass of glop. They're saying you used a map. I'm reading the report here that one of the maps you used,
the CCC thing.
The CCC map showed southwestern United States.
Let me tell you what that was.
Going kind of brown.
Before you give those racist pigs any more publicity.
We got to get you off the table to get your view. What do you say?
Well, let me tell you what my view is.
Yeah.
The nation is should be absolutely ashamed of itself, because what happened is a field producer took a map, unbeknownst to her. She did a frame grab off the web of a map. It happened to have been produced by this organization,
mm-hmm.
a supremacist thing. I mean, it was on the air for 30 seconds,
mm-hmm.
and it 30 seconds, wasn't even on the air that long. It was 3 seconds. And for them to suggest that we had gathered material from this group is scurrilous. And I will tell you, and I told Katrina Van Heuvel, you know, what I thought of her for doing that. That's unconscionable. That's asinine. Let me get to the issue that you asked, which is that I'm a racist, xenophobic son of a gun because I want to install border security, port security in this country.
Mm.
Now, you've just heard the reasons that I've given you for wanting to secure our borders. If those strike anyone as irrational, please don't do it. If they strike you as somehow motivated by some sort of xenophobic impulse, please don't do it. Leave 300 million people vulnerable to drugs, to terrorist attack, and to the policies of foreign governments that will supersede those of our own. Please don't do it.
I'm here
let me finish. Me finish, Tom, please.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the idea that people can throw xenophobic and racist around like that, when you get into the position that I'm in life, you better know who in the hell you are. And I know who I am.
But you know that American history has had waves of exactly those things. I mean, that's just a part of our history. We live with it. We hopefully learn from it.
Here are the facts.
Yeah.
Name one thing I've ever said that is xenophobic. No. Name one thing I've ever said that is racist. I am not I'm not even a person who wants to limit immigration. I want to raise legal immigration.
I'm really asking you a different question, Lou.
Sure.
And it's something like this. I mean, you know, I've got a part of my own family that's been here sort of, I don't know, from the beginning. But another part that came, you know, a century ago,
You're a fancier guy than I am. I don't think I've got anybody who's been here from the beginning.
Well, you know, it wasn't fancy. It was indentured, right? So it wasn't fancy.
All right.
But a century ago, I had Swedes come over, and I had a Swedish grandfather who remembered as a kid in the playground, this sort of playground taunts. It's a joke, but not really, about what's the difference between a Swede and a bucket of, let's say, cow manure. And the difference would be the bucket. And he wasn't bitter about it, but he remembered when that, even for, a white Swede, let alone a person of color, this country could be pretty testy when you start coming in and you're not seen as the top of the pops. Are you afraid that your populist energy could be used by that kind of American that would even go further beyond ethnic to racism, whether you intend it or not?
No, I'm not. As a matter of fact, I'm very careful to make certain of what I say and to make certain that the audience, my audience, understands exactly what we're talking about. I despise racists. I despise xenophobes. I despise, with equal measure, those who distort and twist and torture truth and ignore reality, and those who hide behind such charges, such epithets, their lack of reason, their lack of evidence and fact. And I think that they absolutely pollute the public debate. It's fascinating for everybody to talk in really highly emotional terms. It's not so fascinating to look at the facts. And the facts are straightforward. This is a nation right now whose very existence is being challenged from any number of quarters. But fundamentally, if we are to preserve this nation, we have to preserve the foundation of it. And that's our middle class, for whom the American dream is quickly becoming a nightmare. And that's the reality we have to contend with.
It's a tough one. Hey, Lou, the John Kerry gaffe yesterday about the soldiers, we've just got a minute here. What do you think of that? Is that important, or is that what you put in the chaff category?
I put it in chaff in one sense, but the other sense, I think, John Kerry, good Lord, you've run for president of the United States. One Democratic congressman saying today, he blew the 2004 election. Now what? He wants to blow the 2006. These are very, the whole nonsense around this thing. What was he trying to say, for crying out loud? Why was he trying to say it? And how in the world can an accomplished politician then say what he said? It's disgusting, and it's so off the point. But but really annoying. And I think it's, you know, it's also appropriate that two politicians who are not on the ballot could have so much influence, George Bush and John Kerry. It's time for them to rest.
There's the Lou Dobbs view. Lou Dobbs throwing a big rock in the pond practically every night these days. The new book is War on the Middle Class. Lou Dobbs, anchor of Lou Dobbs Tonight on CNN, thanks very much for being with us this hour.
Tom, great to be with you. Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.